Proudly presented by Provident Payments, this is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and our visit this week with 96-year-old Don Cooley of Watsonville, California, originally from West Lafayette, Indiana. He served with the 106th Infantry Division during World War II and was one of 6,000 from that division who were surrounded and ordered to surrender at the outset of what became known as the Battle of the Bulge. When we left off, he had just gotten into the 9 days he spent locked inside a 40-and-8 boxcar designed to hold 40 men or 8 horses, but in this case, 60 cold and hungry American prisoners.
My job as a battalion clerk, I happen to have in my pocket another blank sheet called a morning report where you list the names of everybody. And so I passed this thing around the boxcar and had everyone sign it that was in there. I think there were 60 of us then. The third day we were strafed because the boxcars were not labeled. I mean, these were, we think, British plays. So they opened the doors and we got out to dive in the ditch. Yeah, it was cold by then. But the point I want to make is that they did run along this train, long train, and open up the doors when the strafing occurred. The trouble is, strafing's over before they could get to two or three cars.
And when you say these boxcars aren't labeled, what you're saying is if they had said POW on the top.
Red Cross.
Then the planes would have known not to shoot.
That's right.
But they don't know.
They don't know.
And so you guys are helpless inside this boxcar, and if they don't open the doors, you're going to have a lot of guys die.
That's right, or you hope that pilot is a bad shot. Some guys took off at that point and didn't come back to the boxcar.
Did you think about trying that?
Not a bit.
Why not?
Well, I think it was because if I had thought about it, I think I would have nixed it because I think it was the fourth day into Germany, third or fourth. That's a pretty long way to get back through the lines.
So you knew.
And no food.
And wherever you're going to be, it's German-held territory. So the likelihood of you getting through all that and back to American territory is rough. And are you getting pretty hungry by now?
Yes.
Are you getting scared?
No, I don't think so. We were with friends. That helped so much.
Well, and you said you celebrated your 21st birthday in a boxcar. I don't think that's how most young men imagine spending their 21st birthday.
Well, I wouldn't interview very many people with that question, but I think I know the answer, so I don't need to.
So what? Did it occur to you that it was your birthday? Did you mark the occasion?
Oh, sure. The day after Christmas.
Well, I guess I should ask you about Christmas, too, then, huh?
Well, there was a significant thing. We started singing Christmas carols in the boxcar, and I get emotional about that. There was another fellow among our group, had a good voice and knew the words. Pretty soon other people chimed in. And the irony, of course, is that that's a German carol, Silent Night.
So you're somewhere in Germany, your prisoners in a boxcar, freezing and starving.
Well, we weren't freezing in there. From that standpoint, we were better off than the soldiers that didn't get caught. It got down to the coldest winter to date there in Germany, and we were sheltered. And that was something to be thankful for.
But here you are, 60 GIs singing Silent Night. Inside a boxcar?
Yeah. Well, it was Christmas.
How did it sound?
They didn't sing happy birthday to me the next day, but I don't think I told them anyway. They might have. You know, what do you do? You're just there all day sitting on your duff and chatting. Because we were in that boxcar for 9 days.
Well, and I imagine you've probably heard Silent Night hundreds of times in the 75 years since then.
Sure. Wonderful song.
Can you listen to it now without thinking of that boxcar on Christmas 1944?
No.
And what do you think about when your mind goes back to that moment with those
guys? Oh, I cloud up.
You might be the only one from that boxcar who's still here.
It's very possible.
I'm not trying to put words in your mouth or make it more than it was, but I can sense just from your description and your emotion that this was a real powerful moment for you.
Oh, yes.
What did it do for you?
Made me feel better, probably.
Gave you a little sliver
and
of hope.
And also, it was another bond with the others that were singing with us, which we needed at that time. I probably knew a third of the people in that boxcar, or maybe half of them that are on that list.
I'm sure everybody listening can imagine what that was like, but that's something I would have loved to have heard. So you said 9 days on the boxcar. You don't know where they're taking you?
No, of course not.
And you mentioned the fact that they hadn't taken your camera when you were captured. Were you concerned that your camera may be discovered? Did you have to hide it a certain way or anything?
After the initial pat-down, which was really not a pat-down, they were in such a hurry because it was getting dark and they needed to get all these guys out of there. I didn't think about it until the end of the boxcar ride because of an incident that was involved. To enter Stalag 4B, enter this big, like Fort Ord, big center, the first thing I'd be done was after 9 days in the boxcar, coming in there was to put through a shower and get new clothes. So you strip on one side of the shower. There's a gang shower. Stalag 4B was controlled internally by British soldiers who'd been there a long time. And so a Brit came around to me and he says, "Hey, Yank, you got anything you don't want Jerry to find?" "Well, I got this camera. How do I know I can trust him? But what if I why not?" So I did. Gave it to him, and a pocket knife that I hadn't been relieved of. And I came out of the shower and was dressing, and this Brit came around to me and said, "Here, Yank, here's your camera." And I snapped a couple pictures in that stalag by shooting from the hip from this deep overcoat. They're not good pictures because of the cloudy weather, but no more until near the end, and that's another story.
But you're about to be confronted by a whole new life as a prisoner in this prison camp. You said Stalag 4B. Tell everybody where that was and what
was
kind of conditions
near,
you had.
Near Leipzig. People might know where Leipzig is because it's a big city. But over in the Elbe River, which is almost to Poland. In fact, it's where the Russians and the Americans met at the end of the war in that area. But that was a gathering center for enlisted personnel. The rules of the Geneva Convention said you could send enlisted men out to work and pay them. And so the Brits ran things inside and they had shows on. And we were farmed out about 10 days later, 25 of us in a boxcar, taken to Halle, H-A-L-L-E, which is about 25 miles northwest of Leipzig. And we were put to work there by a contractor to the army to live in barracks on his. He had a mechanical business of some kind, and he had some barracks to sleep us. And our job was to, with pick and shovel, to go to the railroads. When the railroads would be bombed, they were going through town. It was a marshalling center. And our job was to fix the railroad that our guys came over at night and messed up. So that's where I was after 10 days at the Stalag in January, and we were farmed out to this community, 25 of us.
Was that hard work?
Well, what do you think about pick and shovel and a railroad tie? But anyway, I don't mean to be flip because, yes, it was hard work, and they weren't feeding us excessively. We'd complain about that, and they say, "Come on, you're no work, you're not working." We'd say, "Well, where's the food?" And it wasn't as bad then. Then it was 3 months later when the war was about over.
But the weather was probably better in April
than
January. Oh, it was
getting better all the time, fortunately.
Was it kind of rough when you started with the pick and shovel?
Yeah, it was. It was very tiring, though. We'd march to the place 5 blocks away in town. It was interesting being in town and seeing people and sort of being on the loose. And our guard was a toothless old guy that they could use in the army, and he was not difficult. We knew that the Germans were on the run, being pushed out of France and pushed back over to the German border. We knew that the U.S. or the Allies had them on the run. We were optimistic that this was not going to go on forever. But, you know, another week is forever under certain conditions. I would say our outlook was somewhat optimistic at the beginning, and more so when American planes started coming over and bombing the town.
But for a while, day after day, you're getting up, marching through town. You see German civilians. You're going back to the same train tracks to fix what's been bombed out, and you don't know how long this is going
to
last.
No, don't know how long. And we don't have much time to think about that because by the time you get back, the food they gave us, we would prepare, and we'd be tired, and we'd prepare that. I don't think I've ever sat in there and been really hungry, but certainly not properly fed for doing the work. And as time went on, and it was clear to the Germans how things were going, there was less pressure.
You mean you didn't get any Watsonville strawberries in prison camp?
They didn't quite get there, and raspberries either. Until they tore these out, we had 35 acres of raspberries right here.
Well, and I bring that up because these berries here in Watsonville go all over the world.
I know that.
Now they do. But back then, I mean, that would have probably been worth $1 million to you to get one strawberry. What can you give us an example of some of the stuff that you had to eat, because that's all there was?
Potato soup was primary. I think I mentioned it in my diary, but I remember near the end we climbed over the fence and went to a garden that some neighbor had there and brought back some carrots.
Obviously, this is a difficult situation for anyone and not one you ever expected to be found in. So what was it that enabled you to survive or that kept you going?
Well, the will to keep going and knowing this was not going to last forever. We did not even know about the Battle of the Bulge. We didn't even hear about the Battle of the Bulge until 4 months later when we were released. We just thought we'd screwed up there.
So you knew you guys had been captured, but you didn't know the bigger picture and everything
did
that had
not.
Happened.
I didn't get the New York Times there or San Jose Mercury.
Well, and maybe, given your situation and where you were staying in such a small group, it was probably harder for you to get news than the guys who were back in Stalag 4B.
Oh, yeah, they had radios.
Uh-huh. Afterwards, were you able to piece together what your family knew? You know where you are, you know what you're going through, but how much did your family know about what had happened to you?
They were told within 3 weeks that I was missing in action. They got the he's a prisoner of war telegram a week after I was liberated at the end of April. So they didn't know I was dead or alive for 4 months. I got home practically before they knew I had been released. So that, you know, as a parent, it's hard to stomach having to go through something like that.
You're captured December 16th. 9 days on the boxcar, 10 days in the prison camp. So by the time they've got you in Halle, this is January of 45. You're not liberated till late April of 45.
20th of April.
So what else happened over that time period? 3.5 months. You're doing the railroad work every day?
Yeah, that eased off. Toward the end, when the day bombers, the U.S. bombed by day and the Brits by night. Anyway, we'd go out and in the town, there'd be streets that would have to be cleared a little bit. They actually let us get in bomb shelters a time or two.
What led up to that moment where you realize, hey, I'm not a prisoner anymore, we're free?
Well, it was a more gradual process than that. It was perhaps unique in that on the 13th of April, the Americans arrived at Halle. We had gotten word anyway. They marched us ahead of the Americans. And so we were about 10 miles east, and the Americans ran out of gas because they'd come across so fast. And marched us east. One of the guys had a radio, and that's when we heard that Roosevelt died. So we camped in a farmer's area where he recently cut whatever it was. And the next morning, there was the guard that was in charge of our group of maybe 40 men marched to east, I guess, just to hold on to us. The next morning, said, okay, guys, let's get out of here. And my buddy and I looked at each other and said, this is foolish. I think we asked him what would happen. And he says, it's up to you. You know, he'd given up. And so we
hit. This is the guard you asked?
The guard.
Okay.
So we hit in a haystack and they all marched off.
We need to catch another break, but we'll hear what happened next when we come back. 96-year-old Don Cooley of Watsonville, California, our guest today. Hometown Heroes comes right back after this.